I'm going to talk today about the potential role of dwarf galaxies at high redshift in reionizing the universe. This is a summary of work I've been doing for many years and other groups as well. And I'd like to, in particular, pay credit to my various collaborators. This work wasn't done in isolation, so my seven collaborators who've contributed a lot to the project. So I just want to start off with the central question that we're trying to address here. So it's a little bit wordy, but I'll come back to this towards the end of the talk when hopefully we've answered at least some of these questions. So, you know, the main setup, obviously you all sign up to a workshop about reionization, so you know the universe reionizes the intergalactic medium somewhere beyond a redshift of 6, most probably around the redshift of 10 or so, goes from being mostly neutral to mostly ionized. And of course, you know, it's a classic whodunit. You've got the body, which is the evidence through the Gunn-Peterson effect that the universe went from being mostly neutral to mostly ionized. But you don't know what did it or when, okay? The source of UV photons that you need to do this, that could come from active galactic nuclei, but they appear underabundant at those redshifts. And of course, a good source of ionizing photons is star formation. When you make stars, you make an initial mass function. The most massive of those, 8 solar masses and above, can produce have hot enough photospheres that they have a significant fraction of their black body radiation emitted shortwood of 9-12 angstroms, so ionizing photons. So then the key question is there enough star formation early in history to explain that photon budget? So we've been quite successful in recent years in discovering galaxies at redshift 6 and beyond. That's the Gunn-Peterson era or the epoch of reionization. But the key question is what we see sufficient in ionizing the universe? And I'll throw away one of the punchlines that the answer is immediately no. The galaxies that we've discovered at high redshift are not numerous enough to provide that photon budget. So you need to do some extrapolations. Of course, the natural one is to extrapolate to fainter galaxies that you don't see. So this is the dwarf bit. You see, I'm covering both bases, dwarfs and reionization. This is the dwarf bit of the workshop. Are those numerous enough to provide that? So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Now, who here attended the kickoff meeting for this workshop? Okay, so about half. Who here attended the kickoff meeting and paid attention to my talk? Just one. So I'm going to put in... Thanks, Polly. I'm going to put in a little bit of background. Now, I know some of you, or one of you, has heard this before, but I'll spend the first 5 or 10 minutes just setting up how we observationally find galaxies at high redshift. Then I'm going to bring that what we learn about the luminosity function into the context of reionization. So what's really changed the game for all this is the availability of Hubble Space Telescope imaging going very, very deep, enabling us to probe to high redshifts and probe down the luminosity function. So specifically in the last 2 or 3 years, the installation of Wide Field Camera 3 on the Hubble Space Telescope. So as you know, a popular schematic, it's about the size of a phone booth, goes into one of the radial bays here, an astronaut to scale. And this has been fantastic. I mean, it has both an ultraviolet channel and an infrared channel. I'm going to focus today exclusively on the infrared channel because at high redshift in the observed optical and the observed near-infrared, you're looking at the restrained UV. And if you restrict yourself to the observed UV, you see nothing at all for the reasons I'll explain in a moment. And the fact that this new instrument on Hubble Space Telescope has a field of view that's about 7 times the previous generation NICMOS camera, and an efficiency, a quantum efficiency, about double, and to boot, finer pixels, enabling us to survey more effectively these very compact high redshift galaxies. So here's really a plot of discovery space. So on the bottom, this is wavelength, going from the ultraviolet and the optical into this new regime, the near-infrared for HST, and this is some idea of survey efficiency. This is the area multiplied by the throughput or the efficiency of the instrument. So you can see that the game changer around redshift 5 and 6 was the previous generation advanced camera for surveys, working in the optical out to about 1 micron, and that enabled us and other groups to break the redshift 6 barrier about 8 years ago or so, and find star forming galaxies at redshift 6 and beyond. And now with Wide-Field Camera 3, we're able to push that to redshift 7 and beyond, and you can see with actually comparable survey efficiency to what we had in the well-established optical, where there's been, you know, 40 years of investment of CCDs and the technology is very mature, but using this rather messy infrared technology, which has really only come to maturity in the last 10 years or so. And you can see it's about an order of magnitude more than efficient than the previous generation surveys done with HST with the NICMOS camera. So this has really enabled us to push to the highest redshifts. So this is some of the recent observations. So you can see here, this is a mosaic built up through individual Hubble Space Telescope pointings. It's a deep field, good south, surveyed with Wide-Field Camera 3 as part of the Candle survey. In fact, bits and pieces done with different surveys. This part in the centre I'll come back to, this is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. You've probably all seen this. Now, those of you who work on low redshift dwarf galaxies will find this very amusing, but this is a Wide-Field survey, which is 150 square arc minutes, and it's nothing. Right. So we're essentially doing pencil beam surveys, but it does capture, when you factor in the fact you're seeing very deep in redshift space, it does capture quite a large co-moving volume. But a key question is, you know, with these relatively small surveys, can you go unlucky and sample an underdense or overdense region of the universe? So how globally applicable are your inferences from this?
What is the volume for this in
place of HM6 or something? Yeah, so it's about, I think it's about 100,000 cubic megaparsecs. Yeah, give or take, yeah. People have done a few other sight lines, but not necessarily so deep. So that's a big caveat. It's called cosmic variance, and we have Rachel and many of you have done work on that. But we work with what we have at the moment. So this is a typical field. I don't know why they always observe so close to the moon, but this is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. This just gives you a flavour of what a tiny postage stamp of sky we're looking at. And you can see this is a colour composite. That there are a variety of galaxies there of different colours. Of course, the highest redshift ones are probably going to be red, and we can zoom in on one of the most distant, fairly luminous ones that we've found yet, around a redshift of 7 or so. I'll talk a little bit about the techniques to find these now. So you can imagine, you know, you take a deep image of the night sky with Hubble, and you want to find the most distant galaxies. Now no time assignment committee is going to give you time to take a spectrum of every one, right? So you want to come up with a list of the most likely high redshift candidates. Now, naively, you might say, well, you know, the most distant guys are going to be the faintest. I'm going to take the faintest dots and take a spectrum. On average, you're going to be wrong, because, of course, the luminosity function, which I'll talk about more, favours dwarf galaxies over luminous galaxies. So 9 times out of 10, you'll get a nearby, or nearby meaning redshift 2 or 3 dwarf galaxy, rather than you know, a redshift 7 or 8 galaxy that you're actually interested in. So there's more information needs to go into that, and of course that is colour information. I'll talk very briefly about the Lyman break technique. I know, you know, you sat through endless talks about this, but just for completeness, I'll spend 1 minute saying that we can use the universe itself as a filter to change the colours of galaxies and to isolate the highest redshift population. So we are here, the Hubble Space Telescope. We're observing galaxies in the early universe, surrounded by its local interstellar medium, gas and dust. As the light propagates towards us, it goes through clouds of intervening hydrogen. And if you take the intrinsic source spectrum, where we have a star-forming population of lots of O and B stars, it's quite a blue spectrum here. Very little gets out below the Lyman limit, something I'll come back to. And then you start adding on at redshift, adding on the absorption through gas in the galaxy itself, then that sort of truncates a little bit more here, and the effect of dust tends to redden it a little bit. But then, if you put on the effect of the intervening clouds, this has the effect each of these clouds absorbs at its Lyman alpha wavelength. They're lower redshift, they're bluer wavelengths, so this has the effect of blanketing all the flux below Lyman alpha. And particularly at redshift beyond 6, where the Gunn-Peterson effect comes in, you have almost total absorption below Lyman alpha. So it's no surprise, really, that if you put, this is a sketch again, redshift 4, for example, redshift 4, if you put a filter here, you get no flux, and a filter here, you get lots of flux, and the intermediate Lyman alpha forest region, you get some flux. A redshift 6, it's more dramatic. So the redshift 6, if you look in the optical, you see nothing at all. The universe absorbs all that light. And then at longer wavelengths in the near infrared, the light comes through. And if you were then to compare with all other objects in the field at lower redshift, nothing or very few other objects would display such a flux decrement. So we've got an ideal way to get photometric redshifts, which used to be a dirty word about 10, 15 years ago, but they've now been refined somewhat. This is really the Lyman break technique. It's pioneered by Chuck Seidel and his colleagues in the mid-1990s at redshift 3 and 4, and various groups, including us, have now pushed this to redshift 6, and even out to redshift 9 or so. So it's really changed the game. Within about 2 years, in the mid-90s, we went from knowing about 10 normal star-forming galaxies at redshift beyond 1 to having 1,000 spectroscopically confirmed at redshift 3 and beyond. So two order of magnitude progress in just a couple of years. This technique, although it might not be complete, there are inherent biases, it seems to be a very good way of getting to high redshift. This is just to give you a flavour of the observation. So the same little postage stamp of sky about 5 arc seconds across, imaged in the optical. Look at the centre, you see a nice galaxy pop up in the infrared and is completely absent in the optical. And this, in fact, is a redshift 7 candidate, the Lyman break occurring at about 1 micron. So that's just to summarise that. And then, of course, you can do this over a range of redshifts using different filters which are available to you from HST, redshift 5 through to redshift 8 and beyond. And here's an example of one in each category. So,
is that the same redshift 7 one?
I think it is, yes.
I'm just wondering how many of them look so elongated.
Yeah, quite a few. So I'll come back to the issue of sizes later on. But certainly the two-point correlation function is embarrassing in that if you pick one, almost certainly there's going to be another one nearby. Now, are they part of the same halo? Are they merging? You know, inevitably they probably will merge by the current epoch or within a giga-year or so. So that is quite interesting. Individually, they do appear quite compact. This is one of the exceptions I'm showing there, but I'll come back to the issue of sizes later on. So this is just a few galaxies here from. So there was a real race. The first data from Whitehall Camera 3 came out. It was taken in August 2009, came out in September 2009. And, you know, within 24 hours of the public release, there were three groups, including our own, posted papers to Astro PH, and there have been, you know, many papers since then. This is just a handful of the two dozen or so objects identified in the first release. And you can see, obviously, they all drop in the optical and they're there in the infrared. Anybody spot the odd one out of these three? One isn't at redshift 7. Second one? Well, one is called Z or ZD0, which probably implies it's not actually going to be in a catalogue. And this was actually a supernova that went off sometime in the 5 years between the optical data being taken with advanced camera for surveys and more recently the Whitehall Camera 3 data. And in fact, we have a light curve from this guy. You can see it decay over the 2 weeks of observation. So you have to be pretty careful. I mean, this is an intermediate redshift, a redshift 1 or so supernova. So you have to be quite careful with this sort of thing. That's a possible contaminant population.
So, Andy, what happened to the Langer galaxies, 8.6?
It'll come. Okay, so this is just to convince you, you know, it really is a needle in a haystack. There are about 10,000 galaxies here. We're going from bright galaxies on the left to faint galaxies on the right. On the y-axis, we're plotting how much brighter these things are in the near infrared than they are in the optical, the Z minus Y colour. And we have about, in this field, about 10 robust star-forming galaxies selected through the Lyman break technique, so about one in a thousand if you looked at the complete catalogue. But we're able quite robustly to select these through the colour cuts. Now,
there's some more around there.
Yeah, so.
We come to that as well.
Yeah. it's all planned, you know.
that box that you showed, is that the extra selection box?
That's right.
So why don't you use a selection box that curves, the lower curve, because arrows go up if you go to Defender Galaxy.
Yeah, so the selection box is selected like this. On this edge, the error bars are too big for the photometric stack scatter. So even if a galaxy was intrinsically down there in low redshift, you know, the chances are, you know, 2 sigma of the time it would scatter up there, and we'd pick a load of bogus objects. Okay, probably real objects, but not real high redshift ones. And then we set the line here because of the next plot. So here we ask the question, what can mimic the colours of distant galaxies? So far my entire experiment has been looking at red dots in HST images. So how convinced am I that an individual red dot is red because it's very high redshift, or could it just not be something which is intrinsically red and quite nearby? Okay, so I don't wish to embarrass myself by presenting false information. So we did look at this in some detail. So we're here, redshift 0, we're interested in redshift 7 and beyond. This is that same colour, Z minus Y, or you know, how much redder things are in the infrared rather than the optical. So these are tracks for various populations of galaxies, so starburst galaxies here, spiral galaxies, elliptical galaxies. And where it crosses this line at redshift, colour 1 or so, we would pick it up as a potential candidate. So you can see, obviously, everything at high redshift, irrespective almost of its spectral template, comes into our selection, which is what we want. So the other question is, how much of the time are we going to be confused? So you can see that you dodge quite neatly starbursts unless they're heavily dust extended. But you are susceptible to evolved stellar populations around a redshift of 2 or so. You know, if elliptical galaxies with evolved stellar populations do exist at those redshifts, then we would pick them up as a contaminant. So, and the other contaminant population I'm almost embarrassed to tell you about, because I've dedicated my life to finding the most distant objects in the universe, and yet something with identical colours are the most luminous, the most nearby objects beyond our own solar system, which are L and T type dwarf stars in our own galaxy. Due to molecular absorption bands, they mimic very neatly these Z drop colours. Okay. So you have to be rather careful of that. So this is just to paraphrase.
Can I paraphrase my question?
Yeah. Yep.
You pick a cut.
You pick a cut.
That cut, if you showed it previously.
Yep.
Your errors go up if you go to Defender Galaxy. So you want to sort of have to make your cut number of sigmas.
Okay. You can do that as well. And in fact, for the narrowband searches I've done, I do that, where you have significance contours of the colour going up like that. For this, you can do it, but in fact, the trade-off, I mean, you want to take a cut on signal to noise in a detection band anyway, so you're going to place some sort of cut there to build a catalogue. And then it makes the effective volume quite messy to compute then. And in reality, all our galaxies pile in quite close to the limit, because that's the way nature works, right? You know, these luminosity functions are steep, therefore everything piles in close to your selection limit. So it wouldn't actually, in this case, make a lot of difference if you pick the contours. But it's a good question, and people have used that technique, particularly for narrowband searches.
The other groups use the same selection window?
There's some argument about the selection window, so that's not the full selection window. I'll show that in a second. But people have refined this over the years. So, as I mentioned, this is what we're interested in. This is a log flux now on wavelength here, this is a spectral template of what we're interested in, a star-forming galaxy at high redshift with the mother of all breaks. Yep. This is what could confuse us, a low redshift elliptical galaxy, and a T-dwarf low-mass star in our own galaxy. This is the filter set we have to play with. So you can see immediately that, particularly if you go to longer wavelength colours, you can guard against this by doing a colour plot. So star-forming galaxies, if they are blue and relatively unreddened, will follow this track as you go to higher redshift. You can understand this is plotting the line of break window magnitude. So this is where it enters our selection window at redshift 6 or so. In fact, this is for the redshift 6 population. I should have shown it for redshift 7. And essentially, it goes straight up here. And you can understand that that's the break simply shifting through the I-band filter, okay, until it has infinite magnitude because it's zero flux. And here is the colour longward of the break. So if it's a star-forming galaxy, relatively dust-free, that's quite flat in these units of F mu, which define the AB system. So that's why it goes vertically up. You're plotting the colour longward of the break. What about the stars in our own galaxy? Well, the high-mass stars are here, the low-mass red stars are here. We can select specify a colour window which dodges them quite nicely. What about the elliptical galaxies? This is the track for an elliptical galaxy. And you have to play around with it a bit. You cut a corner here, but you're able to define a colour space where we are relatively uncontaminated, providing you're working at sufficient signal to noise that something like this doesn't have half a magnitude of error and scatter up. So that's another caveat. But my postdoc, Steve Wilkins, worked quite hard to define these colour spaces for the individual redshift slices. And here's just an example of some of our candidates here with the colour error bars and the selection window. And then this is low-mass dwarf stars and elliptical galaxies. So they all sit away from those that are inconsistent within the errors of being those galaxies. Now, of course, we're not going to pick up the whole population. There's two effects going on. One is we have a magnitude cup, so there's going to be stuff which is fainter. The second thing, we have a colour cup, so things which are highly reddened won't appear in our sample because we throw them out as being consistent with being low redshift ellipticals, even if they are generally high redshift. So that's another caveat. Okay, how am I doing for time? So I'm very briefly going to mention spectroscopy, although this isn't the core of my talk, so I'm going to move very quickly on to the luminosity function. But we have had spectroscopic confirmation. We've been working on this for many years now. We've had spectroscopic confirmation of a subset of the population, and going to things like the Keck telescope in collaboration with Richard Ellis, you know, picking up one of these Lyman break galaxies. This is an I-band dropout at redshift 6 in this case. This is kind of the discovery spectrum for this population. You see a single emission line at about 8,000 angstroms, consistent with being Lyman alpha at redshift around 6. So, of course, you know, it's dangerous to trust a one-line redshift. In this case, I'll draw your attention to the very sharp cutoff on the blue wing. This is actually quite typical for Lyman break galaxies seen at redshift 3. It's a function of Lyman alpha being a resonant line. So you can imagine you form an ionizing photon on the photosphere of an OB star. Very quickly that ionizes some atom. Lyman alpha is one of the recombination lines. But that, of course, is tuned to the n equals 1, n equals 2 transition. So it just plays cosmic pinball on its way out of the galaxy. It rattles around. It has a high capture cross-section. And that extends the escape path greatly by orders of magnitude. So in fact, what happens is it's only when it scatters to about 4 sigma away from the velocity, the average velocity of the gas, that its optical depth drops such that it can free stream towards us. So essentially, we just see the backside of a nebula. Okay. So this explains why we have the sharp cutoff on the blue extended red wing tail. Incidentally, you see a bit of velocity structure of this line. This isn't a doublet line, obviously. This isn't nitrogen 5 or some other strange line. We've looked for that. It's way over there. It's undetected. So when I posted this paper to AstroPH, I had a couple of emails the same afternoon. One saying, "Oh, you know, love the spectrum that I saw. You know, you've got this two component thing. This is great evidence for galactic infall." So I thought, "Oh, yeah, that's interesting." And within half an hour, another email arrived saying, "I love the spectrum. Saw the sort of the resolved nature of the line and the two components. Fantastic evidence for supernova-driven outflow." Who knows?
There also evidence for quasar because of the nitrogen 5.
There is no nitrogen 5, and there's no Chandra detection in the X-ray. It doesn't rule out an AGN, but it limits its contribution. So basically, all the UV light we see, we think, is star formation.
Based on the fact that you don't see it.
Yeah, that's right, and the fact that it's spatially resolved, just. Okay, so I'm just going to spend 1 minute on this plot. So, of course, we've measured Lyman alpha for a subset of our population at redshift 6. What I'm plotting here is equivalent width. It's a histogram of equivalent width. The equivalent width is basically the ratio of how many photons you have in the emission line at 12.16 to those in the surrounding continuum. So why should we care about this at all? Well, of course, the emission line is indirectly proportional to the ionizing photons. That's what powers the recombinations. Yep. So that depends on the UV luminosity short of 9.12, where the ionizing photons are. But the surrounding continuum around 12.16, of course, is not due to those photons at all. So essentially, the equivalent width of this tells you something about the hardness of the spectrum which is doing the ionization in this galaxy. And that depends on many things, metallicity, on initial mass function. If you put in a plain vanilla Brousseau-Charlot model, solar metallicity, usual star formation, been going on for 10 megayears or so, 100 megayears, some reasonable number, it's quite hard to push above 100 angstroms in the rest frame for equivalent width. So that sort of sets an upper limit on what's reasonable for, you know, a plain vanilla model. Okay. Now, of course, I mentioned already that Lyman alpha is resonant and therefore gets killed by dust. So typically, in the Lyman break population at redshift 3, the more typical value is 10 angstroms, right? Because this resonant effect, this line is quenched. However, when you go to redshift 6, you get quite a tail going out to equivalent widths, which would be illegal in sort of the normal model. So what we see here is evidence for evolution that the incidence of Lyman alpha emission seems to be higher and stronger than it was at redshift 3. This is at redshift 6.
Given that spectrum that you just showed me,
yep.
What is the error on your equivalent width?
Well, okay.
Individual measurement must be huge, right?
It would be if you use the spectrum to determine the continuum, but you don't. You use the image from HST. You subtract off how many photons you know came from the line, because we had a 20 sigma detection of that line. And the rest is attributable to the flux above Lyman alpha emission.
In that case, are you sure that you count that second component Lyman alpha, or is that some other?
Yeah, but that's 10% effect. So, you know, there are error bars on everything, right? And I haven't always shown them. But you can get a reasonably robust. The hard thing is detecting Lyman alpha in the first place, right? Because you don't see it in all the galaxies. You see it in about a quarter. Now, that's not to say that...
quarter of the redshift 6 galaxies?
Yeah. That's not to say the other ones are not redshift 6. Yep. So, in fact, 22% or something. Yeah, that's not to say that the rest are not redshift 6, just to say that in those cases, Lyman alpha didn't get out, right? And then some of them might not be redshift 6 as well.
It's like half redshift 3, right?
Yeah, but you can go a lot fainter in spectroscopy, right? You probe down to equivalent widths of 5 angstroms or 1 angstrom instead of whatever our limit is. Okay, so...
So the fact that you're here quite at 75 angstroms suggests that you sort of have... error bar of 75 angstroms, right? Well, 75.
No. That's what we can detect. The limit is not our ability to measure the continuum, which comes from the HST imaging. It's typically many sigma. Okay. The limit is the ability of our spectrographs to get this line, and of course both of those things affect your equivalent width limit. Yeah, because it's the ratio. Right, so this is just to show that this is the Gunn-Peterson effect by another name, right? So here we have, as I said, redshift 4, I didn't plot redshift 3, but it's there. At redshift 6, we have, Lyman alpha at quite high equivalent widths in about a fifth or a quarter of the sample. But we've more recently, this is work done with Dan Stark, been looking at redshift 7 and beyond. And in fact, we find that the incidence of Lyman alpha emission drops precipitously. Now, this probably should come as no surprise, because one of the big discoveries in the last 15 years or so was the Gunn-Peterson effect at redshift 6.3, quasars, there's no transmission below Lyman alpha, and presumably the damping wing then starts eating into the Lyman alpha emission. But in fact, this is simply a limit here at redshift 7 that is sort of marginally inconsistent with the redshift 6 value.
How many spectra do you have of Richardson, candidates?
Okay, so we tried a bunch. I mean, we have of the order of 10, 15, which are not yet published, but some are published here.
And that's why it's number limit, because you just haven't seen it in any.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
And why does the error bar blow up at Richardson 6.5?
That doesn't come from my sample, that's from the narrowband imaging stuff, so I'd need to check on that. Okay, so as promised to my friend and colleague Andrea, so there was excitement about a year and a half ago or so when Matt Lennart targeted one of the Lima Break galaxies that we and other groups had identified in the first release of data from the Wide Field Camera 3. And this had vanished in the Y band at 1 micron. So this is consistent from the broadband colours with being a redshift 8 galaxy. So three groups independently discovered this on the same day and published. You know. And then sometime later, Matt Lennart, who wasn't involved with any of the teams, got director's discretionary time on VLT to follow this up with an instrument called Symphony, which is an integral field unit, so you get a two-dimensional spectrum over a slab of sky. And he published in Nature this spectrum, where I feel your pain. To guide you, there's a big circle around a blob which is supposedly 6 sigma that is at the same significance as some skyline residuals around it, although this actually does not sit on a skyline. So Matt claimed, although his paper is quite fair, there are a lot of caveats in it, that this is consistent with being Lyman alpha at redshift 8.55. That's slightly below what the photometric redshift estimate would be. That's more like the high eights. So I'd actually been awarded time already to observe this, which was sitting in the ESO queue for X-Shooter, and Matt managed to trump it by getting director's time. But anyway, so I did obtain a spectrum of this, which is a candidate I'd actually selected, you know, the year before. And unfortunately, I couldn't confirm it with my own spectra, one of which came from the VLT and X-Shooter, which is quite a sensitive new spectrograph. The other one came from the Subaru telescope and the Mawx infrared spectrograph. So here's what I actually saw. This is the reduced data. Here I've smoothed it just to guide the eye a bit, and this is where we expect the source to be. And then this is what we would expect adding in an artificial source with the same flux and wavelength as the Matt Lennart source. So we'd expect it to pick it up at 4 or 5 sigma or so, and we didn't actually see it. Now that doesn't completely kill it, but I think I would suggest it makes it unlikely that this is real. But this is a hard game. I don't want to be harsh on Matt Lennart. I mean, you know.
So the Lennart line was just noise?
Or a reduction artifact. Yeah, or we've done our data wrong. But I think that's unlikely because we don't see it in two independent spectra.
So how many hours did they use on Symphony?
They were about 16, and we had 11 hours on Mawx and a few hours on X-Shooter, which is actually more sensitive. Yeah. Right, so I'm going to go back to the core of my talk, which is what we can learn from the discovery of galaxies within the epoch of reionization, specifically the luminosity function, and address whether these galaxies can or cannot provide the ionizing photons to reionize the universe. So, of course, you know, the simple thing is we select a bunch of galaxies, we count the number, we have a luminosity associated with each one. That luminosity is in the rest frame ultraviolet. We can just add up in a particular redshift slice and say, what is the co-moving number density of ionizing photons, and can we use that to reionize the universe? However, it's not quite that straightforward because, of course, your different fields have different sensitivities. As you push to higher redshift, typically, of course, the break will shift through your filter set. So the galaxies will get very much dimmer, not simply the distance, luminosity distance squared effect. It's also the fact of the break moving through the filters causes them to fall off a cliff, essentially. So you need to model this rather accurately as you push to fainter magnitudes and higher redshifts. Also, as Rachel pointed out, some of these are spatially extended. Typically what people do is put down a metric flux aperture and count the photons within it. Of course, how much light is falling outside the aperture? What people have done is to take low redshift galaxies and just produce a correction based on the size of the size in the ultraviolet of low redshift galaxies. However, that approach is entirely wrong because the size of galaxies evolves. So we try to do this in a self-consistent manner, and a key issue is what is the size of high redshift galaxies, i.e. to what extent do you capture all the flux with an aperture that's small enough to produce high signal to noise but is big enough to actually be representative of the total UV light. So here's a radial profile. This is how the flux falls off as a function of distance from the core of a galaxy. This thing here is one of our galaxies. This thing here is a star, of course, with the optics of HST. A point source isn't a point. You have a point spread function. And you can see our typical galaxies are resolved, but barely. We're talking about half-light radii of the order of a tenth of an arc second, which is about 1 kiloparsec. So no surprise, galaxies at high redshift are smaller than galaxies at low redshift. But it's important to quantify that effect to when we simulate to estimate our completeness and our effective volumes. We need to know what this behavior is.
Sorry? The star at what distance, or does it matter?
That doesn't matter.
There.
Well, I mean, yeah, there. Okay. It wasn't the sun. I mean, it's under the sun. Yeah. Okay, so and this is just to give you a flavour of what happens. So obviously the typical size, half-light radius of the galaxy is correlates with its absolute magnitude, brighter things are bigger, but it also depends on the redshift. So here, this is work done by my postdoc Stephen Wilkins. So at redshift 4, the half-light radii, when you account for the PSF, a couple of kiloparsecs or so. And then by the time you reach redshift 6, it's less than a kiloparsec. So you can put that in to your models to estimate the effective volume. And of course, what we do is we put in fake galaxies. We determine our recoverability as a function of redshift and as a function of magnitude. And that affects the volume of the survey in each redshift slice and down to whatever the magnitude limit we pick. And we're...
So you don't know the distribution size, right? You've only detected those that you've detected because they were above your selection.
That's right. So, but we've also simulated what we miss. So you can put in an artificial population. You can say at what point does what we detect conflict with that imaginary distribution? And the other thing, and people always banging on about low surface brightness galaxies. I mean,
but even at redshift 0, we don't know how to do that.
Yeah. Okay. When Goods, which is quite a shallow survey, came out, it went down to about 26th magnitude, which corresponded at redshift 6 to star formation rate, 15 solar masses per year, something like that. Okay. And we produced the diagram I'm about to talk about, the Madal-Lilly diagram. And then various people said, yeah, but what about low surface brightness galaxies? However bright they were, because the emission is extended. With HST, you're very biased towards point sources. Surely they could explain most of the malformation. So when the Hubble Ultra Deep Field came along, that went a factor of 10 deeper in sensitivity. So we did the experiment. Was there any 26th magnitude object that was then smeared over 10 or 100 times the area? Yep, that we'd missed. So we're able to go to the Goods depth and intrinsically a much deeper image and address, had we missed anything that had extended brightness? And the answer is no, okay, to that depth. So, of course, it doesn't rule it out at 28th magnitude, because you can play the same game here. Oh, yeah, but low surface brightness galaxies, they only come in really faint, and where does it end? Anyway, so, anyhow. So this is the famous and much maligned Madal-Lilly diagram. So what this plot purports to show is a function of redshift from redshift 0 to redshift 8 and beyond that we're interested in now is how rapidly the universe is converting its gas into stars per unit co-metering volume, stretching through the expansion of the universe. And you can see that perhaps there's a peak around redshift 2 or so. Our discovery at redshift 6, which is now confirmed, trend and pushing to redshift 8 now is the universe at redshift, these redshifts, was actually quite a quiescent place. There were very few highly active star-forming galaxies, much fewer than in the well-studied past around redshift 3 with the Lyman break population. So when we first published this initial work in 2004, I stress this has since been confirmed by other groups, there were just howls of anguish from the community, you know, that nobody wanted to believe this point was so low, and you know, people were very upset, but it does appear to hold up. You know, obviously I'm giving a talk, so I'm giving a highly personalised view, but it does appear to hold up, and the groups who initially disagree with it, you know, people like the Goods team and Barons, in later work agreed that in fact so something like a factor of 6 fewer actively star-forming galaxies, that is, with star formation rates above 10 solar masses per unit co-moving volume at redshift 6 than there were at redshift 3.
Sorry, well, on the previous yeah. diagram, there were like a sequence of like.
Yeah. Okay. So I skipped over that.
The wrong ones.
So this is our work, which is correct, and this is the work of other groups. And, without being flippant. So this, in fact, was the Barons' work. This is all the same data. These 4 points. And initially, this is what Richard Barons did. This is using low redshift or intermediate redshift. Images, UV images of galaxies to correct for the aperture effects, the flux falling outside. And he overcorrected, and you know, he's obviously a good scientist and recognises this. And when you apply those corrections properly, he's in agreement with us. And he's done that subsequently in his work.
Can you comment on the fact that the people that are looking for star formation, try to determine the star formation rate from GRBs,
yeah.
are finding much higher level of star formation 6 and above?
Yeah, so that might be due to a number of factors. Ignorance of GRBs is one of them. Dust obscuration is another. Remember, we select purely in the rest frame ultraviolet. So there's a bias against dust obscuring star formation. But I'm going to say in about 4 minutes time. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so this is a few key points. So is the universe at redshift 6 and beyond really forming fewer stars than it is at redshift 3? So, you know, a few caveats. Obviously, the data I presented from Goods only went down to quite a high star formation rate a few times, that of the Milky Way. We tried to make a fair comparison with the redshifts by effectively truncating their samples to the same rest frame ultraviolet luminosity or star formation rate. But when you want to correct to address what the global star formation rate in the universe, you obviously want to correct for the galaxies you don't see, and that starts to become dangerous. But you can.
Is there a correction at redshift 3?
Depends on the luminosity function. So you can take the observed luminosity function.
It just shows.
Yeah. So everything in the previous thing was down to the same limiting luminosity. But it's done using the rest frame UV luminosity determined at each redshift to do the integral. So this allows for variation in the faint end slopes.
But you don't correct the other incorrect angle for the galaxy density.
That's well. What I did is I went back to the data and I removed that correction.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's make sure that what we showed is at each redshift.
At each redshift,
integrating down to L star.
L star.
At that redshift or a fixed value of L star.
10 solar masses p, which is L star redshift at redshift 3.
All right.
And how much do you worry about cosmic variance at redshift 6 or beyond? Because you really only, yeah. you only have like these tiny little.
Well,
especially if the galaxies are as clustered as you say they are.
Yeah, so there are a number of deep fields now. There's only one truly deep field, but there are a number of HST fields constraining the bright end of the luminosity function, and also some parallel time data. It does indicate that cosmic variance is an issue. People have found, you know, overdenses at redshift 5.9. Stiedel, even at redshift 3, is finding redshift spikes. So it is an issue. However, the volumes surveyed do suggest that the result is, you know, wrong by no more than 30% or so. So we're not talking about factors of many. Okay, so we build on this since, but this is, you know, when we initially discovered the quite low star formation rate at redshift 6, which we now pushed to redshift 7 and 8, We actually had a NASA sort of press conference on this, and they produced really nice graphics. I don't know whether you've seen this. So you know, they plotted both as function of redshift and as a function of human years, what's going on, this is star formation rate, density, universe. And the great thing is that you don't even have to plot anything on the y-axis. So, you know, it's completely schematic. But this is just to emphasize why people were upset that the star formation rate density relationships are quite low, because this is the onset of the reionization period. And if anything, you'd like a large reservoir of UV ionizing photons to ionize the universe. If you don't have much star formation out there, you struggle and you're in something of a conundrum. So this is the updated Madow-Lilly diagram. This is from a paper with my postdoc, Steve Wilkins. Steve is the first author on this. This is pushing to redshift 6, 7, 8 here. You can see the downward trend continues.
Okay. So this is the same thing measured above 1.5?
This is now measured above, this is a lower limiting star formation rate because it depends on the deep fields, and that rather than being 10 is more like 2 solar masses per year.
Now the open circles correcting for dust.
Yeah, so the higher points are dust corrected, and then for reasons I'll explain, there's not much dust correction at high redshift. We're going to come on to that. Oh gosh. Okay, so you don't need to see this because you see that a billion times the universe reionizes.
Yeah,
so that's all the evidence. I'll be asking questions at the end, so don't be bluffing. Okay, this is quite a key equation here. So this equation basically relates the production of ionizing photons in galaxies, which is mapped onto a star formation rate. Now, it's not truly mapped onto star formation rate. It's mapped onto a production rate of OB stars whose photospheres are hot enough to produce ionizing photons. And then, of course, there's a leap of faith, which is called the initial mass function, which gets you to the star formation rate. So you notice here, this is the what you require to keep the universe ionized in terms of star formation rate density. You've got a 1 plus z cubed term because, you know, the universe expands, and in the past it was harder to you had more particles per unit volume. You've got a baryon density, of course. You need at least one ionizing photon per baryon. In fact, you need several because you need to keep on pumping in photons to keep the medium ionized because there's a recombination time. And there's something called a clumping factor, and that is simply the smooth medium is much easier to reionize and keep ionized than the clumpy medium, because in the clumpy media, the overdense regions, the recombination time is short. Okay, so you need to pump in more. So this clumping factor a few years ago was 30, and now I'm informed in the last year or two is 5. There's some
being.
Yeah.
Cloud on Jason's 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll leave it as a free parameter until the theorists can get their act together on that. And then there's another thing, which is the escape fraction, which is what fraction of ionizing photons formed on the photosphere of OB stars actually battle their way out of the big slab of neutral gas, which we call a galaxy, into the intergalactic medium where the recombination time is long, where if they produce a reionization there, they do the universe some good. You know, that remains ionized for a Hubble time. Whereas most of them will be mopped up near to the star within the galaxy where the recombination time is short. So this is escape fraction is highly contentious. I mean, we know it's between 0 and 1, but, you know, beyond that, I think people really don't know. So just to reiterate, if you add up the galaxies we see at redshift 6, we fall short of this requirement to keep the universe ionized by a factor of 3 or so. Okay. So what's going on?
You say very cavalierly that AGN cannot do the job.
How
do you
know? Yeah. Well, Xiaowei Fan told me. The AGN luminosity function, the renaissance for AGN was around redshift 2 or 3. After that, the luminosity function really drops, and it drops more significantly than what I showed you for star-forming galaxies. Witness, you kids has been looking for redshift 7 quasars, and they got 1 right at the end of their survey.
But they're only sensitive to really bright AGN. We have no idea how many faint AGN there are.
Yeah, that's very true. And is Massimo.
As long as they're extra baryon constrained, you cannot put too many faint AGN, otherwise you overproduce the X-ray backup.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I need to speed up a little bit. So this is just a little bit about the escape fraction. So escape fraction is highly uncertain and highly contentious. At redshift 3, it might be of the order of 10%. In fact, in the galaxies observed, people have looked. What we talk about the escape fraction is what gets out just below the line and limit that has the ability to ionize, photoionize hydrogen. And what people like Dan Nestor and others have done, they've taken typically a filter just below the Lyman limit, and they've looked at Lyman break galaxies at redshift 3. These redshifts are known accurately, and they've said if there's any flux, come there. And it appears quite binary. Sometimes you hit the jackpot and you have a high escape fraction, but normally it's zero. Yep. So on average, I've heard 10% or so. In the low redshift universe, locally it's about 1% for the Milky Way and local group galaxies.
But you can't, if you have a lot of cases with zero, I don't think it makes sense to average the meaningless, because you don't know what the distribution is, right?
Well,
it makes sense if you have like a well-defined value in something else.
Yeah.
You see 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 10, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0,
So the worry is, of course, that the escape fraction depends highly on galaxy mass or galaxy luminosity.
What you really need to know is distribution. Without distribution, average is just given. If you don't know the distribution, average is meaningless.
Right. But really, you'd like to know it as a function of galaxy luminosity, because then if you're doing the overall budget for ions and photons, you need to have both bits in.
Well, ideally, you would want to know for each luminosity what the distribution of escape fractions is. You know,
yeah.
Before that, it would be nice to know what the distribution is for all luminosities.
So people are making progress at redshift 3. Redshift 6, I think it's a lost cause, because the Gunn-Peterson absorption means that, you know, you're never going to see anything there anyway. So this is the big flaw in all this work, in ultimately answering the question, can galaxies reionize the universe?
If you can't do it with escape of 1, then...
Yeah. So this is what I've always done. This is what I've always done in my work. I've said let's be generous. Let's have F escape is 1, and as a thought experiment, if that was the case, do we have sufficient star formation? As I said, even in that case at redshift 6, based on the galaxies we see, down to 1 solar mass per year, that's not the case. So of course, what we need to do to complete the thought experiment is address the contribution to the galaxies below our limit. The contribution of dwarf galaxies to the realization of the universe. So this involves measuring the luminosity function, but there's a lot that goes into this. This view graph is produced by Steve Hawkins, just to emphasize that the effects that we take into account, essentially the distribution of sizes. The colors are also important. We're doing a color cut, so you worry about what you throw out. So you want to try and correct for that. Dust obscuration, all these feed into the what's called the effective volume, which is a function of how faint you go and the redshift. And from that you can recover the luminosity function. So we know through our work and the work of other groups such as Barons et al. That the luminosity function does evolve. So here it is at redshift 4, this is from the Stardell work. And this is now the frontier at redshift 8 or so. So the luminosity function, there are fewer luminous star-forming galaxies. It's all in the rest frame UV, nothing to do with stellar mass for all you dwarf galaxy fans out there. This is purely star formation rate. Okay? And at redshift 8, there are fewer star-forming galaxies. And there's some argument about what exactly in the Schechter function evolves. We know it does evolve dramatically. So this is just to emphasize the point. This is at redshift 3, this dotted line. This is our data at redshift 6, and now we've pushed this to redshift 8 also. This is just to show that you do require evolution. And now the most recent work in the last year or two, redshift 2 or 3, redshift 6, and now redshift 7. So if anything, it keeps on dropping as a function of redshift, which is embarrassing, of course, because you need the high ionizing photon count. So, as I've said here, an increasing problem for reionization, you require steep faint end slope, that is, most of the UV luminosity comes from dwarf galaxies that you don't see. You need the biggest contribution of unobserved galaxies. So at this point it ceases to be science, because you're evoking a population you haven't yet observed. And you need a high escape fraction, and you need a low clumping factor, which means a smooth idea. Sorry?
Why do you call it a problem, actually? I don't understand that.
Challenge.
Yeah.
Increasing promise realization. I don't see it as a problem. I see it as this, the fact that we know that there are smaller galaxies than the one you're observing.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, so I don't see it as a problem.
Well, it is a problem because if you what I haven't said is if and I think comes in to you last time is okay. So it depends critically on the faint end slope. If alpha, like it is locally, is -1 or -1.3, all the luminosity essentially is locked up in galaxies around alpha star. Okay, and no matter how faint you integrate, you're not gonna greatly increase the number of photons. If alpha is steep, which it isn't at low redshift and it isn't at intermediate redshift, then you can solve the problem. But is the faint end slope steep? So this is what this is hinting at. So this is a confidence plot. These are 95% and 68% contours for the parameters of the luminosity function, the characteristic luminosity, and the number density. This is the value at redshift 3, and this is what we measure at redshift 7. Okay, so you have strong evidence for evolution of the Schechter luminosity function that is not enclosed with any significance within the contours. And it seems that primarily it's evolution in L star, or M star, so evolution in the knee of the luminosity function. I've plotted up three different faint end slopes here as well. So this was stolen from Richard Bounds. This just shows you our state of knowledge at the moment, that it appears that L star evolves. Certainly the whole luminosity function evolves. There are fewer star-forming galaxies at the high redshifts. Richard actually has a point which I removed, one galaxy at redshift 10 that he draws a luminosity function through. I thought I couldn't really do that. So this should shock you, and perhaps the optimists in the audience won't be shocked, but what we show here is this is where we observe. We observe to UV absolute magnitudes of -18.5 in our deepest field. Okay? And this is these green lines are the UV photons in these units. There should be a per cubic megaparsec there as well. In these units as a function of this limiting magnitude. The clumping factor here is 5, I think. I need to double check that. Okay, so this is what we observe. Yep. These lines here are what you require to ionize the universe at, in this case, redshift 7, for escape fractions of 0.5 to 1. Okay? So where these green lines cross these vertical lines, wait, where these green lines cross these horizontal lines, you're in business, because potentially you can provide enough ionizing photons to fry the gas between the galaxies. So I'll draw your attention to, if you have quite steep luminosity functions, which we measure at redshift 3 and are much steeper than they are at redshift 0, you still fall short. You need alpha, this faint end slope, to be close to -2 in order to stand a hope in hell of producing the ionizing photons. But what I want you to remember is this is what we observe. And to constrain any of this with the current observations is, to be honest, a bit of a joke. And it's a real leap of faith. You're trying to go over many orders of magnitude. So people who claim that they have solved the realization of the universe on the basis of those observations of high redshift galaxies are not telling the truth. Okay?
So how much farther?
People have claimed there's a problem also.
Yeah.
So there's some evolution here. What do you mean? You keep this luminosity fucking constant for...
No, there's evolution. Well, we've observed evolution in the...
Just to keep it ionized.
To keep it ionized,
right.
Yeah. And it's probable that you need...
You're ionizing one ionizing
photon. No, you need a few depending on the clumping factor.
But you can't express that as an instantaneous lab.
Yeah.
You need a structure in history.
No, it's what.
So it's two constraints. One is to keep it ionized, and the other one is to actually get it to be ionized.
So this is what?
This is to keep it ionized.
Keep it ionized. So that's. Right.
Yeah. So this faint end slope, I mean, as you said, Tom, I mean, there's evolution of the luminosity function. But, you know, where does it end, right? So this is various constraints, intermediate redshift and high redshift going down. So it does appear there's a trend to steeper luminosity functions, the highest redshift. But I'd remind you, if you get the minus 2 and you integrate all the way down the luminosity function, you have the embarrassment of ending up with infinite ionizing photons. But, yep.
In the previous plot, isn't the last point consistent with the first point?
Yeah,
it was not. Yeah, so we need better data, we need to go fainter. Yeah.
Okay. How can we say that it's a trend? I thought the trend was like 4 sigma or 5 sigma, that was during the conference here. But I wouldn't say
that. This isn't my plot, this is from Richard Bowens. There is a trend to steeper luminosity functions at high redshift. But the redshift 8, there's not, you don't probe sufficiently down the luminosity function to get good constraints. Right? But you do require, if you believe that star-forming galaxies reionize the universe, you require a steep faint end slope. Now, it would be good to confirm that observationally at redshift 8 and redshift 10. But that's not the case.
But during the conference, there was a claim that it's detected 4 sigma, that slope steepens.
Yeah, but not a redshift 8.
Your plot doesn't show it any redshift.
Well, Bowen's plot, yeah. I just wanted to give a flavor of that.
It was based on Borg survey, where they combined high luminosity with low, and they clearly see
it's not a redshift.
That's
6, 7.
Work goes up to 7.
7, yeah, but not. I mean, the big error bar is redshift 8, right? Okay, I'm.
They're combining Ophidia.
So this is trying to address the key point of the talk in the workshop, you know. So we have insufficient ultraviolet photon density from the UV luminosity galaxies that we select at redshifts beyond 6 to explain reionization. There is some evidence, although controversial, for a steeper faint end slope at higher redshift. Now, as I mentioned, you know, if for a reasonable alpha at an intermediate redshift, most of the photons would come out around L star. But I'd remind you, of course, that we're talking about restrained ultraviolet, and we're not talking about luminosity function in terms of stellar mass at all. So you know, I went to the kickoff meeting, and I enjoyed it greatly, but it was a meeting of two halves. The first half was high redshift guys talking about what I did, about the role of dwarf galaxies, right? The second half was fascinating talks, which I was largely unaware of the impressive work done in dwarf galaxies in the local group and beyond. But at no point did anybody mention a luminosity function or an alpha or anything. So is that, my question is, do the low redshift dwarf people not parameterize stuff in this way? If you constructed a UV luminosity function, sorry to put people on the spot, but if you constructed a UV luminosity function, what fraction of the UV photons come out from dwarf galaxies versus L star galaxies, for example? Just throw that out there. And what is the nature of the faint end slope at redshift 0? Another point, you know, as I said, you integrate down to 0 luminosity, you get infinite luminosity density. What's a sensible lower limit in absolute magnitude? Should it be the magnitude of a single OB star, absolute magnitude of a single OB star, or you know a dwarf galaxy at minus 10? You know, what should we be doing here? It's another question for the local group people. You see, I'm trying to embrace the spirit of a workshop. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up now because I've run a few minutes over. So what are the ways out of the puzzle? We've skirted around cosmic variance. We could have star formation at even earlier epochs, necessary to reionize the universe, but you still have the requirement to keep the universe ionized. Or you could even change the physics a bit. That is, the dirty words of initial mass function. You could experiment with that. You could.
Yeah, I'm
not telling
you. You measure the UV flux.
No, you don't. You do. You measure the UV flux longward of 1216 angstroms. But that's not what reionizes the universe. It's the photons shorter than 912. So to get back to my point about the equivalent widths of Lyman alpha, you're using something which you know can't reionize the universe because those photons are not energetic enough, but you're taking a leap of faith, which is the hardness of the ionizing slope. Now, that depends on the initial mass function, depends on the metallicity, depends on all these factors, that we are under-constrained or not constrained at all at high redshift. Now, inevitably, you can say population 3, yeah, you know, mass stars, you overproduce those. But this is just to emphasise that you know all is not necessarily solved. So
you said it flows around, not that's not mostly from the passage though.
It is, but I mean, it all comes from massive stars. But you know, if mainly you produce B stars rather than O stars, then the shape of your UV continuum is very different. And I
the ratio
of
ionizing to non-ionizing
yeah.
Yeah.
Huge.
No, it's not.
Okay.
That's not a factor two.
Okay. So this is just to show you the work we've done on the colours of high redshift galaxies. I'm out of time, so I'm going to skip through this. So basically, one discovery that we made with Elizabeth Stanway many years ago was that star-forming galaxies at redshift 6 are blue, much bluer than the same population selected in the same line of break technique at redshift 3. Okay. Something is going on, and what this plot shows is when you change various parameters, like you know, reddening always makes stuff redder, so that's no good. But you can experiment with other parameters, star formation history, the metallicity, the IMF, etc., in order to try and massage these things to be somewhat bluer. And in fact, again, if you read our initial paper in 2005, it was just after Nick Moss had a cryocooler put on it. It had run out of cryogen, shuttle mission, put the cryocooler on it. I had the data, I looked at it, and I was terrified that it was just some calibration error. Yep. So all the way through, there are caveats in this paper, right? But it turns out that we were right. You know, with WIF 3, people have confirmed, people like Barons again and Dunlop have confirmed that these things are really very, very blue, embarrassingly blue. So I'm going to skip ahead a bit because I'm out of time. But essentially, if you love dust, you're out of business at high redshift, because in the galaxies we see, which remember we pre-select for being UV selected, appear to have little or no dust. Our preferred solutions are no dust, but of course that depends on the IMF, etc. So that's interesting. That's not to say that there's not an entirely different, highly obscured star-forming population. So I'm going to wrap up now. So what is the future for this? The future very much is the James Webb Space Telescope. This Vigros is a little bit out of date because the launch is actually 2018. And anything we can see with Hubble, we can take a good spectrum of with this satellite. So that is, we can get the redshift. We also work at longer wavelengths. We can push to higher redshift, potentially up to redshift 20. For the population around a redshift of 6 or 7, we can get multiple emission lines in the West Flame optical. H-alpha, H-beta, O3, O2. We can get metallicities, we can get dust leavenings out of that. We can even probe whether these extravagant claims about changes in the IMF that are really true or not. So there's very much a lot to look forward to. And let me just...
You can go a bit fainter, right? That's still true?
Yes, and we can probe further... further down the luminosity function. I just wanted to leave you with a somewhat controversial slide. If galaxies don't do all the ionization, what does? Do quasars still play a role? Well, I addressed this somewhat in my talk, but certainly the ones we see have a minimal contribution at redshift 7 and beyond. What about mini quasars, low mass black holes, potentially even stellar mass black holes? I went to talk by Felix Mirabel last week in Japan, where he said that X-rays from these might play a role. X-rays, of course, might be quite neat because they could get further into the intergalactic medium, and then one X-ray photon can produce many ionizing photons ultimately. So that might provide penetration into
this. This was considered by Nick Nitta and Marta Lowenthal. They concluded it's a very small effect.
Yeah, okay. But Felix Mirabel, in his paper last year, reckoned that.
Yeah. But even if you have tons of X-rays, you can only ionize to about 10-20%.
Okay, yeah.
Right. So, but that could help, right?
But you still need 90%. Yeah. Right? So.
Not so much.
Or do we need, if galaxies can't do it and intermediate mass and low mass black holes can't do it, do we need something exotic like decaying relic particles? Apparently not. Okay, so just to recap, we found in the last 8 years or so star-forming galaxies, first at redshift 6 and now up to redshift 10 or so. We've got spectroscopic confirmations at redshift 6 and we're fighting our way to redshift 7 and redshift 8. The number counts imply that these newly discovered galaxies on their own would struggle to reionize the universe. Many have very blue restrained UV spectral slopes, hinting at perhaps very much lower metallicity. potentially different star formation history or even different IMF. All these might help boost the number of ionizing photons, the physics that goes into that. The escape fraction is unknown. It appears that a high escape fraction would be required, certainly at steep end slope, if galaxies at high redshift were the primary cause of reionization. And James Webb Space Telescope spectroscopy, and also imaging to go further down the luminosity function, may solve many of these questions, but I don't think it will solve the escape fraction issue, and certainly it won't see all the way down the luminosity function, so we'll always have a puzzle about do dwarf galaxies reionize the universe. Thanks very much for listening.
Don't tell the US Congress that JWST won't answer the question.
It's being recorded.
So if we see a galaxy, a Lyman Ray galaxy, a redshift of 5, and it has no Lyman alpha, we say, oh, okay, it's dust, that makes sense, there's no Lyman alpha when there's dust. If we take the exact same object, but now it's a redshift of 7 instead of redshift of 5, and it has no Lyman alpha, we say, oh, okay, that must be going to produce an area. But they're spectroscopically the same. So I'm wondering whether this bedtime...
No, one would have a bluer UV slope in the end.
But if we just saw the same object, the redshift of 7, our instinct would be, oh, okay, well, there's...
Yeah, but the photometry wouldn't be the same. Right?
Would they be the same? I'm just wondering. I mean, we have this bedtime story that there's dust at low redshift and Gunn-Peterson damping at high redshift. I'm wondering whether slit losses could actually be playing a big role.
Yeah, I mean, your point's well taken that Lyman alpha, as I said, is resonant. So, in fact, it can scatter out over a bigger halo. And this has been seen in a few cases at redshift 3 and 4, you know, like the Slidell and Lyman alpha blobs and things like that. So with a slit, you might miss some of the integral field units can address that. And the next generation spectrographs like KMOS will be able to look at that in some detail. I think you can tell the difference between dust absorption, not specifically for Lyman alpha, it is the resonance issue. I mean, people shouldn't use Lyman alpha at all, really. You know, but it's the only line you can get from the ground. We should just call a moratorium and wait until JWST and we can get these other lines that can do real science with. But in terms of dust, I mean, yeah, the spectral slopes are a lot bluer. Ultimately, we'll get H-alpha, H-beta ratios to get the Balmer decrement. We already have Spitzer data, and a lot of the time, you know, you can rule it out because you have non-detections with MIPS or the IRAC 8-micron channel. So for normal dust reddening, you know, SMC, LMC, Milky Way, Calvetti, you can actually rule out a lot of those things. Of course, that's only for the brighter galaxies, for the fainter ones.
At redshift 4, you have MIPS detectors? I think so.
At redshift 4, you have MIPS. You have upper limits at redshift 6.
Yeah.
Right. But that rules out the most extreme dust scenarios. Let me show you the Spitzer, the IRAC stuff is more pertinent. Okay, just can I answer this question? Right, so, okay, this is what we see at redshift 6, okay? These are stacked, all our redshift 6 galaxies. So we have a point here, a point here. These are the IRAC channel 1 and 2. Channel 3, barely detected. Channel 4, 8 microns, undetected. Okay, this is a regular starburst spectrum with a little bit of dust. Inconsistent. Goes through one of the 4 points.
Lots of dust. Point one.
Yeah, this is no dust for Andrea, okay? Inconsistent with two of the points, right? Something's different, you know. And what I haven't shown is the MIPS. Now, MIPS is way up there, but it blocks, you know, when you plot a distribution of allowed reddenings, there are some extreme cases, and the MIPS stuff rules that out. Okay, you had a question.
Oh.
Yeah.
So just in the keeping with the spirit of the workshop, just to comment, sort of very nearby, you know, local group dwarfs, I guess the reason you never see, you know, UV luminosity functions is that at zero redshift, the rest frame UV is emitted in the UV.
And yeah, so but you've got Spitzer, right?
Yeah, so I mean, there are things...
Spitzer. What's the other one, Galax?
Yeah, so there's Galax, so I mean, that's probably one of the best bets. There's also... you know, you want to obviously be doing wide field studies, so again, Galax is reasonably good. There's also various cameras from the ground which you can do it. Massey has a survey of star-forming galaxies in the local group, of which there's only 10. So, you know, in that respect, it's I think it's probably just a much harder observation to make in terms of the star formation histories, etc. So particularly, I think the star formation is relevant for reionization. The problem with all the nearby galaxies is if you can actually see the old stars and reconstruct a star formation history, your age resolution or your time resolution in the oldest spins is basically just older than 10 giga-years, which, you know, I think covers redshift, goodness knows what, to a very large number. So in that respect, you probably just don't have the time resolution to actually see, you know, what was the contribution of photons at very early times. Although you could, in principle, convert all of the star formation histories that people derive into, you know, ionizing fluxes and such like. I've just never seen that done.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, you're getting the old population just from, you know, red giant branch stars. I mean, the UV flux of a lot of galaxies in the low is basically zero. I mean, they just have, you know, red giant branch stars or whatever, so there's not a lot of blue light.
Yeah, that's useful. I just had a thought, because people would talk about dust, and yeah, you know, dust, I love dust and stuff, that's great. But for the once in astronomy, if you're interested in reionization, you don't care about dust collections at all, because what you see is what you get. There's no point correcting your star formation rate for dust obscuration to compare with the Madell-Hart and Riesz equation, because those photons never get out and never do the...
Well, hold on, alpha fraction of the Lyman break galaxy that you showed before, you meant it's a lot.
Yeah, but for reionization, for the reionization calculation, in fact, you actively don't want to do any dust correction, because if you do, you get it wrong.
No, but if you base your suggestion for realization on the fraction of Lyman breaks to Lyman alpha, you're saying I'm not saying Lyman alpha meters at that ratio because the universe is very ionized, then you have the degeneracy with the dust.
Yeah, that's true.
In the local universe, the H alpha and the UV doesn't necessarily come from the same place. So,
But considering our resolution is hundreds of parsecs at high resolution, kiloparsec, but maybe at that level, probably does.
I mean, all of the young stars that you're seeing now, though, in terms of which are emitting all the UV flux in the very local universe, you know, well, that's the star formation that's going on right now.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know. How hard is it? So I want actually to clarify on these things of the X-ray ionization.
Yeah.
I agree with you, the X-ray only ionizes 10% in the
crazy.
But the idea of the mini quasar ionization is not, the mini quasar are supposed to emit the
X-ray. I agree. Most of the photons come from UV.
Exactly. So they are redshifted X-ray, they're going to the UV. And therefore, those are the ones that do the contribute to the ionization, actually, whatever, six or whatever. And mostly they tend to ionize the low density regions. They are not able to ionize the field density. But it could, you know, help in a sense. The voids, for instance, in the simulation are fully ionized already before you have ionization. Of course, you put a lot of.
I mean, it's a bit. Yeah, it's a bit unclear. One can cook up a scenario where.
You have to put a lot of mini quasars, but it does. It's not reliable by observation in the sense that it doesn't violate the X-ray background constraints.
Yeah, but how do we motivate them?
No, it works enough.
I don't know. I mean, in the absence today as well.
What's that?
In the absence of them today as well.
What do you mean absence?
Well, it's just, you know, having a high number of them to do reionization and they have enough accretion rate to produce.
There are a lot of quasars.
Mini quasars.
What does it happen to the remain, the medium mass black hole or stuff like that around? I don't have a scenario. I mean, there could be many scenarios. There could be the seeds that grow into supermassive black hole. They could remain around. It'd be very hard to see them.
Only if they are 10 to the 4 or so, because if they are beyond.
Yeah, you can make ULX as an iteration.
Exactly, but then we would still have to explain why there is none of those today. Or very few of them.
You know, if you have 100 solar mass black hole, it's very hard for it to appear that it don't have any great right? Given. Today, for sure.
Even before,
today even more. So it would be basically invisible.
That's exactly what I mean. Is you know, if you want to sort of, you know, describe that and worked on this too, with a sort of simulation.
Yeah, so probably they are too inefficient at accreting, and maybe there are not enough sources. I don't know.
That, then they don't sample the dense regions. On top of it, even if you throw them into larger objects, then, there's just so many things.
It's hard.
Even if you would have worked back then and you had some sort of story, then you still would have invoked a new story to say, why don't we find a whole bunch of them today?
But today, it's not too hard to hide them, that's my point. I mean, if they are so inefficient,
you're saying the same thing. Right. If they agreed so inefficiently, then we should just stop talking about it.
No, but today is special, right? And what if the density of the universe was behind?
It's just going to mass function thing.
But, I mean, you want to make a time bomb, right? All these X-rays which redshift into UV, and because of the general slope, you need a lot of light bulbs and high redshift. Some fraction of them should continue accreting at low redshift.
You probably have to have a different population from the AGN that you see today. You cannot just extrapolate, the luminosity function of the AGN you see today, and say it may cause, and it has to go down and then up again. I think something like that. That is contrived, perhaps, but. For instance, you have to do a lot of that. I'm not saying this is I am just saying that is a scenario, maybe implausible scenario, but in any case, on Tuesday, I'm going to show you some, we talked about it, some simulation of accretion onto intermediate mass black holes, moving black holes and non-moving black holes. And, most of the format that people use, the Littleton or Bondi, are when you include that, well, this is including radiative feedback, are a distribution produce quite different results.
But still, when do you see
It's orders of magnitude less.
For the moving black hole, though, it's a bit better than the Bondi Littleton.
So why don't we see enough ultraluminous X-ray sources if they're still around? So because when they pass through the disk or any molecular cloud, they should light up.
So the efficiency is very low, and so you need these things to go through 10 to the 6, density core, and you need a lot of seeds and. Because the field factor of this region is so small. So, I mean, you don't expect to see many, if any, in fact, right, today.
And as a consequence, you never contribute globally to the UV or?
Perhaps, but the high redshift, the ISM was a bit different than in the Milky Way.
But that's just a plausibility thing. You can only have so much mass in 10 to the 6th part per cubic centimeter. If you have it there, it'll only live for a dynamical time because it'll make stars. And the covering fraction will always be small. So
we don't know exactly the structure of trace galaxies, but one thing is that they tend to be more gas rich. The higher redshift galaxies are quite gas rich. The velocity, the circular velocity is smaller. They tend to be more dwarfish type of galaxies.
When's your talk?
Awesome. No, but you're going to be disappointed because I'm not going to be putting everything together into a picture that shows that the higher edge you can have.
It's been in 4 days.
Maybe I can do it in 4 days.
Expecting great things, you know.
Maybe we should thank Andy.
Yes.
Self-appointed chair.